This week, the precious metal sector rebounded from oversold conditions amid renewed tensions in Ukraine. Hello, everyone. Your host, Chris Walczak, back with an infotainment-packed episode this weekend. So most of us aspire to be millionaires, but billionaire? Well, that's maybe beyond the dreams of avarice for most of us. With signs of a gold bottom, though, showing up, who better as a featured guest than a man who turned his millions into a billion through the precious metals markets? That's right, you don't accumulate 1,000 stacks of $1 million in the gold market without knowing a little bit more than the rest of us. Billionaire entrepreneur and founder of Sprott Asset Management, CEO Eric Sprott, says the official economic numbers are bogus. Most people know they're paying more for life's necessities than reported. Even after spending trillions of taxpayer dollars, well, the Fed has accomplished little other than put the U.S. further into debtor's prison. Last week, the EU put savings accounts with over 100,000 euros at risk of confiscation. Eric Sprott says that investors across the pond should be bracing for something similar, unless, of course, savings are held in physical bullion coins and bars. But according to his research, physical demand for gold exceeds global mining output in one nation. China is consuming all of the gold produced in the entire Western world. Bank trading desks combine their financial clout with the leverage facilitated by paper contracts to manipulate the precious metals markets. He shares a recent headline story of a homeowner who found a container of gold coins in his backyard, worth only $30,000 when first buried, now worth maybe $10 million, just showing you the safe haven qualities of the yellow metal. And our second featured guest, CEO and president of Exelon Resources, Brendan Cahill, has a unique mining company that recently earned top scores at tickerscores.com. Our GoldSeek president visited the firm, and to say he was impressed is an understatement. Precious metals virtually flow from the ore, according to Peter Spina, at their La Platosa mine, which is the highest grade silver producer in Mexico, a country already known for mega silver output. In addition, it's still one of the lowest cost operations nationwide. Top institutional investors are putting their money into the shares, including Sprott Asset Management, who owns a sizable position in Exelon shares, giving investors that extra peace of mind of knowing that the big boys also have faith in company management and future prospects. And if you haven't yet signed up for the Alpha Stocks newsletter, this week we had yet another big explosion in our favorite gold stock that also carries a nice dividend. This is a nice, solid, safe company, and my investors are already turning a profit. If you haven't yet signed up, you can send over a request or just use the links in the email messages and on the webpage. GoldSeek.com radio begins now with a Market Weatherman report. Sunny skies appeared over the precious metals exchanges later in the week after a retest of the lows. The greenback fell sharply from resistance amid concerns over a new Cold War between the West and Russia. At Friday's closing bell on the New York COMEX exchange, investors accumulated bullion in shares. Gold added $10, finishing at 1303, reclaiming the 1300 point. The yellow metal is still higher for the year by over 6%. Silver added about 10 cents, ending at 1973, and silver shares are topping the barcharts.com best performing sector. In fact, silver stocks are approaching 54% at last check. So the shorts are getting squeezed in that sector, and couldn't have happened to a nicer bunch of folks. Palladium dropped 1350, closing near 809 on supply concerns due to sanctions by the West on Russia, the source of roughly 40% of global palladium supply and top producer of the metal used primarily in catalytic converters. Platinum finished at $1,424, up about $10. The largest platinum companies agreed to pay directly to striking South African workers, bypassing their union following a 13-week walkout. South Africa is still the source of about 40% of the world's palladium. And West Texas Intermediate crude unfortunately fell sharply, about $4, still holding above that century mark at $100.50 a barrel. Gold reached a six-month high on news that Russia annexed Crimea. Tensions returned this week in Eastern Europe. On Friday, Ukrainian officials mobilized troops against pro-Russian separatists to isolate their easternmost city at the center of the conflict to avoid civilian collateral damage. On Thursday, the Ukrainian forces were victorious, that is, until Russia activated thousands of troops, probably Spetsnaz, lined on the national border. Investors plowed funds into the precious metals in a mad dash on Friday that caught even many seasoned gold bulls off guard, but not this old geezer. I directed alpha subscribers into my favorite dividend-paying gold stock on Wednesday, and by Friday it was higher several percent. Gold is the go-to safe haven amid geopolitical instability, but also during uncertain times, which can, of course, occur at any moment. And that's why I think all sensible financial professionals should advocate precious metals ownership. Several weeks ago, I cautioned listeners and readers that our media pundits were carelessly discounting this conflict. Well, Peter Schiff thinks so too. The CEO of Euro Pacific Capital reiterated the potential for a run to $5,000 an ounce in a CNBC interview, noting that the best performing asset class of the year, well, it's gold and silver. Schiff noted that expectations that the U.S. recovery is real and that the Fed will end all QE is most likely wrong. Investors need to be patient, though, for the precious metals. Back in the 1990s, they gave up on gold just before it began the amazing 12-year bull market that took prices higher by nearly, hold on to your hats, 900%. Although the bears are calling for lower prices, Schiff says the bottom is likely in place and the stage could be set for a retest of the 2011 apogee. Bottom line on precious metals. Well, gold and silver ended the week on an upbeat note, and so did the equities, with the U.S. dollar closing below resistance, vulnerable to further selling. There appears to be enough momentum left to carry over into next week. If so, gold and silver, plus the XAU, must hold firm, though, into next week's close. For the time being, I'm holding on to the Alpha Stocks gold shares in anticipation of further gains. Moving on to the Wall Street Report, clouds appeared over the New York Stock Exchange this week on increased tensions between the West and Russia. For the week, the Dow was down 47 points, ending at 16,361, and the S&P 500 was barely off at all, just about 1.5 points, finishing at 1,863, while the Nasdaq held key support at the 4,000 level, down 20 at 4,075. And the top stories holding stocks in abeyance this week were dismal earnings reports and the Ukrainian drama. Ford Motors' first quarter net income fell sharply, while Microsoft announced a smaller-than-expected profits number. Meanwhile, Chancellor Angela Merkel expressed grave concerns to President Vladimir Putin regarding the situation in eastern Ukraine, insisting that his country must maintain the Geneva Agreement designed to ameliorate the Russo-Ukrainian crisis. The U.S. threatened additional sanctions against Russian interests, including the financial and energy sectors, that is, unless forces fall back, alleviating tensions. The U.K. Telegraph article I shared made it clear that there is far more at stake here than just a turf war between neighbors. The chessboard has been set among the global players who understand the finer nuances of the game. And only the prepared observers, i.e. gold and silver investors, realize that these military matches oftentimes morph abruptly into more serious games of Go, a much more complex scenario that implies a new Cold War and perhaps something more extreme. Bottom line on Wall Street. Well, the seven-component sentiment index pendulum did something unusual this week. It closed in the mildly fearful category, despite the sell-off. Now, this suggests a change in underlying mechanics and sentiment. We should more than likely expect some further selling next week. Coming up after the break, more GoldSeek.com with Eric Sprott and Exelon CEO Brendan Cahill. So we'd like for you to stay with us right here at GoldSeek. Well, the precious metals sector is arguably One of the best performing markets of the year, so it's a pleasure to welcome back to GoldSeek.com Radio a pioneer in the field, the founder of Sprott Asset Management. Eric Sprott has more than four decades of experience. He's dedicated his life to sharing the opportunities in the sector. Sprott Asset Management manages over $4 billion in precious metals and related equities. Welcome back to the show, Eric Sprott.
Hey, Chris, happy to be here. And I'm not so sure I'm sharing your optimism about the performance of the group here to date. I mean, it was wonderful for the first 2 months, and it kind of faded. This is not untypical of what we all have to go through, but at least vis-a-vis most other markets, we've done okay.
We have to keep in mind that we had the solid 12-year rally, unlike anything we've seen maybe in the history of the market. This is a managed retreat. You know, when investigating the prospects for the precious metals, economic factors are important. I wonder if we could begin the discussion today with an overview of the economy. This is something you keep your finger on the pulse of, and you are concerned by the official employment numbers and the participation rate. Perhaps it might be called the non-participation rate, because that's what some of the numbers are showing. I wonder if you could please tell our listeners how these inaccurate numbers may have a negative impact on our living standard.
Sure, Chris. Well, I think as most listeners know, and most people who are at all familiar with precious metals, the reliance on government data is essentially at a new low. I think for the most part, data is put out there to give us the impression that things are going well. I mean, there's been lots of work done. I think the best work is by John Williams at ShadowStats.com, basically showing that the real unemployment rate is substantially higher than is being reported to us, which I tend to totally believe. We've seen data on disposable income, where I think it peaked out in 07 and essentially been going down ever since. And even as you look at what's going on today, there's a tremendous uprising of the costs of various basic food materials. We've seen some huge increases in prices. Of course, it never gets to be reflected in CPI. I don't happen to be a believer in the CPI data that's released, because, you know, anybody who's really living knows that, you know, the cost of healthcare and the cost of insurance and the cost of pretty well everything else, anything that you buy, is way beyond these artificial numbers of 1 or 2% that we're supposed to believe in. So the 99% is not well off, and if they're not well off, it's pretty hard for them to step up their spending. And that's why we've had, ever since the financial crisis, we've had the meekest of recoveries, considering that, you know, we've run tremendous budget deficits. We spent huge amounts of money on buying back bonds by the Fed, and with very little to show for it. So I've never been an optimist on the economy here. I just don't see it recovering the way the central planners think it should be recovering, and I think it's safe to say that it's nowhere near accomplished what they had thought they might accomplish.
John Williams, who is also a regular on this broadcast, has pointed out that his unemployment figure is roughly 23% and growing at a steady clip, a factor of many fold above what the Fed's numbers are showing. So I think your point is well made. And, you know, while it's hovering near these multi-year lows, still millions of workers have tossed up their hands. They've given up looking for work altogether. And this seems to skew the results, because it seems to put a positive spin on what otherwise would be a lackluster or even dismal number. Any comments?
Well, it's shocking that the people dropping out of the labor force seem to have the impact of making the unemployment numbers go down, which is a bit of the whole joke of what's going on. And I think if we were to, you know, there's one statistic I always fall back on, and it's sort of since 07, the number of people on food stamps has gone up by something like 30 million people. And in order to qualify for food stamps, your income has to be below a certain level. So the fact that 30 million people all of a sudden qualified over these last 5 years is, I think, the best statement one could make about the real status of and strength of our economy.
As that number increases, which is, I think, emblematic of a society that's truly exhibiting signs of distress, they're now cutting back on the program just when people need it the most. You know, the threat of bail-ins first, I think, made the headlines at least in a profound way with the Cyprus situation. Many investors lost a significant share of their savings. And last week, the European Union included some what people are calling dubious legislation that put deposits over 100,000 euros at risk of confiscation. Do you think that investors in North America should be concerned that something similar could unfold right here?
Well, Chris, there's no doubt in my mind. I've always thought that the fundamental weakness in this for about the last 15 years is leverage in the banking system. As you know, lots of banks are levered 30 to 1, which means you got about 3 1/3 cents of capital supporting a lot of the assets. So if the assets fall down by 3 1/3%, you have no capital. And obviously, in 08, we had declines way beyond that. And the various governments had to come in and bail out their banks. And by bailing them out, of course, their bonds then got re-rated down, and they finally figured out, well, we don't have enough money to support them if our bonds are going to get re-rated down. So they had to come up with some other policy to try to deal with the weakness of the banking system. And that, of course, was bail-ins, and it was exactly eventuated in Cyprus. But, of course, it was talked about before that, and you can see why the talk is there, because the banking system in most countries is bigger than the government, so there's no way that the government can take on that responsibility. So yes, I think everyone should have a very deep concern about whether or not they will be impacted by a bail-in in the short to medium term.
I think it's well said, and the only thing I'd add is just briefly here, everyone listening to our voices today, have the opportunity to buy discounted life rafts and life preservers to protect against any unforeseen Cypriot or MF Global-like event on the horizon. I mean, it's just that simple. And the great thing is, it's discounted compared with 2-3 years ago.
Absolutely. It's, you know, most people in our business tend to think that it's all about survival here. And I can tell you, when I got involved in precious metals back in 2000, I realized that the NASDAQ was just massively overflated. And I always used to use the phrase, I'm just trying to survive. I guess I consider myself very fortunate that in that attempt to survive, I invested a lot of my money and clients' money in gold, silver, and equities. And as you pointed out earlier, I mean, the returns in that sector were just unbelievable, as the one of the indexes, the UE Gold Index, went up close to 1,700% over that decade. So it's proven that it's a survival area, and I would encourage everyone to participate.
You've also made an interesting observation regarding the Shanghai Exchange in China. This index apparently makes good on delivery several fold that of its much, much larger counterpart, the COMEX. And you note that the nation may be consuming the entire global mining output, if I understood it correctly. I wonder if you could tell our listening audience more about how this could affect the precious metals sector.
Well, there's been lots of great work done on Chinese demand. We've done lots ourselves. And as you know, the data from China, the mainland, is non-existent. So we are always forced to go to other sources. And whether it's imports and exports from Hong Kong or whether it's the actual deliveries in the Shanghai Gold Exchange, many people, myself included, but I think the most noteworthy is a fellow named Koos Jansen and another one named Alistair McLeod and ourselves that have pointed out that based on all our data, it looks like the Chinese demand is well in excess of Western mine supply. Of course, that's just one country, let alone all the other 180 other countries that would be participating in the gold market. So a lot of my research in the first instance was based on the fact that the physical demand for gold was in excess of the annual supply. And I believe that's gone on for the last 14 years, by the way. And it's gotten extreme in the last 3 years because China's come into the market and bought these huge tons of gold that are visible, let alone the tons of gold that aren't visible. And it's sort of, I find it interesting that I saw an announcement out of China that Beijing will now officially import gold. And the reasoning was, well, whatever we import into Beijing, it won't get reported. So in other words, if you bypass Hong Kong and it goes directly into Beijing, we will never see the data. But we all know that the Chinese demand has changed dramatically. One of the sort of ironies of the gold market is in the last 2 years, the Chinese have at a minimum bought an extra 1,000 tons a year. in a 4,000-ton market. So if somebody comes in and grabs 25% market share at the same price that the price of gold goes down, which is almost impossible. I mean, imagine if they bought 25% more of the oil market, the wheat market, and then the other market, you'd never expect the price to go down. So that's sort of the impact of the paper markets versus the real world, and something we still have to deal with.
It's well said. And, you know, I think one of the interesting side notes here, that when that gold crosses the singularity event horizon, it essentially disappears because, for the most part, gold is not exported from China. There are actually considerable restrictions, which is ironic because it's just the opposite of India, which was another topic I wanted to just briefly touch on here, which has plans, I understand, to lift many or most of the import curbs that have been in place. And this could potentially send global demand into overdrive as China and India, I think, jockey for the title of largest global gold importer. Any quick comments?
Well, we don't know what the status is going to be of the changes in gold importation. Chris, I have my own explanation of what happened last year, and I think what happened last year was in India was that the central banks put this raid on gold. They intended to drain the various ETFs, which they did, and all of a sudden, to their horror, the Indians started buying massive amounts of gold, so much so they actually bought 168 tons in the month of May, which would have represented about 80% of mine supply for the month. And I think the word went out from central banks to the Royal Reserve Bank of India, hey, you're wrecking our game here. We're trying to drain these supplies because we need to make deliveries and we don't need the gold going to your country. So could you please put some restrictions on? And I think the Indians were all too willing to help out their fellow central bankers. So they had, whatever, at least 20 different initiatives to reduce imports. Yes, there's some discussion with the election going on that they will change those rules. We'll all look forward to that. I'm not going to assume it happens till I see it happen.
Gold and silver market manipulation, a top issue here for quite some time. And apparently you agree with a lot of Gatta's work. We've, of course, had Bill Murphy here and honored to have him and Chris Powell on the show. The powers that be are apparently working behind the scenes to suppress the prices of gold and silver. I wonder if you might outline your case for precious metals manipulation.
Well, I believe there's a very strong case for that. I've always recommended recently that people read a book by Dmitry Spek called The Gold Cartel, which kind of lists exactly when the manipulation started, which he pinpoints at the date of August 5th, 1993, where central banks were trying to keep gold down to make everyone, one, believe there was no inflation, and two, believe that everything in the financial business was stable. And he documents very well what happened. I think subsequent to about 2000 or sometime in the last decade, I think the central banks, the hedge funds got involved, or the bank trading desk is probably more appropriate. I think bank trading desk got involved and realized we can move this price up and down almost at will because we can sell 100 times more physical than there is physical, and then we can move the market around and panic people out in the selling, and we'll buy it, and then we'll get them to buy it, and we'll sell it, and been a bit of a ping pong match here with them against the various trading accounts, and of course all the trading accounts lose all the time. So I'm a great believer that it's been manipulated. We had the study which was mentioned in Financial Times by a company called Federes that said the LBMA fix was manipulated 50% of the time. We had the comment by the equivalent to the SEC in Germany, an acronym is BaFin, that said that possible manipulation of gold is worse than LIBOR. We had them investigate Deutsche Bank in the middle of December, in the middle of January. This comment came out from that organization the same day. Deutsche Bank pulled out of the LBMA fix. And I've spoken to lots of people involved, including the lawyers that are involved in some of these lawsuits. And I think there's a very strong case to be made that it was manipulated. And it's funny, Chris, that people, you know, you mentioned the word manipulation. It's almost as though, I mean, what's not manipulated these days? I think the burden of proof is on other people because LIBOR was manipulated, Forex was manipulated, interest rates are manipulated. I mean, I just think that the hand of government is everywhere, and they'll make the data and statistics look like they want them to let them carry on doing what they regard as business as usual. So I think there's a very strong case. I totally support Gatta and all the efforts they've had, and it's going to be... It'll be a tough case to prove in court, but I have no doubt that it happened. We had a whistleblower out of London who you know, tipped off the CFTC that manipulation was going to start in this minute. This is 2 weeks before it happened on this day. Sure enough, it did. And, of course, just got swept under the rug. But I think where there's smoke, there's lots of fire there.
The onus of proof certainly falls directly on the shoulders of the officials, especially given the number of cases where we have seen, as you rightly pointed out, the LIBOR, which I sometimes feel like that caught the media just blindsided. Market after market, we've seen manipulated, and gold and silver relatively tiny to much of the market manipulation. And because the LIBOR is just so pervasive, you know, I mean, it even extends into the massive $3 trillion Forex currency markets. They obviously have the ability to do virtually anything they want. You've also identified an interesting cycle in the price of gold, how the gold price tends to make significant bottoming patterns in the summer months as well as the year end. How could this come into play in 2014, please?
Oh, my goodness. Well, of course, the point I was making that people who manipulated banks aren't manipulating for the bank. They're manipulating for themselves so they get a big fat bonus. And most bonuses are determined at the end of the first half and the end of the second half. So I found it rather interesting that the price of gold touched about 1180 at both times. And of course, by their books, these traders would have made a fortune shorting gold and then, of course, expected to receive a very large bonus. And it just, to me, it was just another sign of evidence that things were manipulated. And there is other work done in on the trading in 2013 by people more mathematically minded than I am. And, you know, where some people are saying it's 6, 7, and 8 sigma events. Well, an 8 sigma event happens once every 40,000 years. And there was Jim Willey, who I believe is a PhD in mathematics, said that the chance of that, what happened to gold happening in 2013, was 1 in 1 quadrillion. So there's lots of evidence around that what happened in 2013 was very, very anomalous.
My one concern is that those models, this 40,000-year model with regard to the sigma events that he's referring to, are highly dubious. They're based on the Gaussian normal distribution. There's been huge breakthroughs, starting with Nassim Taleb, Fooled by Randomness, and so many other excellent books recently. Yeah, that really shows we have to deal with the Lepta-Kurtic model, which is just a fancy stats term for fat-tailed models. We have to flatten the curve. And we're allowing for greater incidence of these black swan events they refer to. You've also noted that the powers that be raided the gold ETFs by knocking down the price, which caused ETF holding liquidations. Nevertheless, silver holdings did not decline on a relative basis when compared to the gold ETFs. I wonder if you might share the significance of this event.
Well, you know, Chris, they struggled with that at first. You know, why? I mean, everybody hated gold and silver theoretically. Everyone was selling gold and silver theoretically. But the silver ETF never declined. And it seems so anomalous to me. And, well, what could possibly be the reason for it? And, of course, you get that light switch going on. And to me, it was, well, the central banks didn't need silver. They needed gold. And I think that's why they brought the raid on. And all the investment dealers that recommended selling gold at the high were the same market participants, for example, in the GLD. They all bought the GLD shares, which is fine. But when they converted them to gold, why they converted them to gold, I don't know. Well, I do know, because the gold was needed. And that's why I go back to, you know, this whole process of knocking down the GLD, getting everyone to liquidate, and then being able to deliver the gold against what otherwise would have been a shortage of gold. And of course, which was kind of backfiring because China wasn't going to cooperate, and certainly India didn't cooperate until, you know, the boys got to talk to them. But that's what the whole plan was, and that's why I think the silver ETF had actually net additions in 2013.
As silver, I think, regains its rightful place as a monetary metal, I wonder if you expect the gold to silver ratio to come back in line with more traditional levels.
Well, I've always thought that. I mean, there's so little silver around. I mean, it would take, you know, sort of one decent guy with big pockets could probably buy all the silver that's kicking around. Again, even last year, you know, when the Indians changed their tonnage purchases from approximately, well, went up by about 4,000 tons last year. Well, we only produced something like 2,500, 2,600 tons of gold, and bang, in comes this extra demand of 4,000 tons. which is something like a 16% of the market share they just took out in 1 year, and all of a sudden the price goes down. It's almost the same analogy as the Chinese coming in and buying an extra 25% of the gold over 2 years. India comes in and buys 16% of all the silver available, and the price goes down. And, you know, not all silver is available for investment anyway. And you know that that silver that went there was for investment purposes. I can assure you that it wasn't for industrial purposes, because you can't change that much in 1 year. So, again, it points out that the chances of silver getting back to normal ratios and outperforming gold are quite stunning. I would also point out that the U.S. mint sales this year, we sold 95 times more physical ounces of silver than gold. We produce 11 ounces of silver for every 1 ounce of gold. It's available for investment probably in a 4-to-1 ratio, and yet those people buying from the mint are buying 95-to-1.
I wonder if you think that is representative of this poor man's gold concept, where as the precious metals market really started to gain momentum, the everyday folks simply would become priced out of the gold sector and would start to turn to AG because it's, well, a much lower price incrementally. Any thoughts there?
Well, I think it's always been part of it, right? That's not a new story in the sense that it's new in 2013 or even this year so far. But it could also be that, you know, smart investors realize that silver can give, has way much more leverage. And, you know, there's probably, I don't even know what the numbers, but there's probably 150 times more gold sitting in dollars sitting around the world than there is silver. So, you know, if you're expecting inflation or financial crises or wars or some darn thing, you know that silver is going to outperform gold. So maybe it's just smart money going to work in the best product.
You know, you've also shared an interesting story about an individual who found a can filled with gold coins in his backyard. And when the gold time capsule was originally placed in the yard over 200 years earlier, the nominal value was around $30,000 at the time. You calculated this current value to be about $10 million today. And I think this is an excellent story that illustrates how significant gold is at protecting purchasing power today as it did 200 years ago. Do you care to outline any additional nuances of this tale?
Another thing I'd say is imagine if you actually buried $30,000 bills. Now, who knows what the dollar bills were like back 200 years ago, but they might have been issued on various banks, which no longer exist. I know banks used to issue these notes. So unless for its rarity value, the $30,000 was still worth $30,000. And perhaps in a lot of instances, $30,000 was worth nothing because the banks had subsequently gone broke. So I think the analogy is, well, you know, if you and I started burying, you know, $100 notes today and versus gold, you know, what would the $100 notes be worth and what would the gold be worth 200 years from now? I think we all know what the relative value would be, which is, in essence, the proof that gold holds its value over time.
It's well said. And the only thing I'd add is that, you know, a time capsule filled with gold just back in 2001. Precious metals is now over 5 times the initial investment. So wouldn't it be interesting if investors listening to this interview said, you know, I'm going to take their advice right now and maybe in the next few years experienced even greater returns. So it's something that I think is just as relevant today. And I wanted to move on to the next question. Some in the mainline media are claiming that the gold price downdraft will soon resume, noting further how the price has a destiny with $1,000 an ounce. I wonder if you might outline just why this forecast could be a bit off target.
Well, one thing you know, the mainstream media doesn't know much about anything. They're, in my mind, just pawns of, you know, the make everything look great theory when everything isn't great. So I wouldn't put much strength in that. We know that there's a huge interest in keeping the price under control, both at the central bank level and obviously even by the investment banks who've been, for the most part, net short these metals. So I wouldn't tend to buy into anything written by the media and or by the participants, the commercial banking participants in the gold market. So I just tend to ignore it. The one thing I always fall back on, Chris, I just look at the demand, the physical demand for gold. I look at the supply of gold and say, there's no way it can stay down here. There is going to be a, I don't think the Western banks honestly have any gold left, to be brutally honest with you. And I thought that in 2012. So in one way, I guess I wasn't surprised that the raid happened in 2013, because I think there were some deliveries to be made that couldn't be made. So I just fall back on the basic premise, more and more people buy gold all the time. I mean, let's take the most recent example. The Ukrainian currency fell by 70%. If you own gold, you didn't lose a dime. But if you own the paper, you lost 70%. If you would have had gold in Cyprus instead of money in a bank, you would have been okay. If you would have been in Venezuela and held gold, Argentina, any place where the Japan, for goodness sake, where the currency just fell by 25%. There's so many examples of where gold is by far the better investment versus the fiat paper.
Only thing I would add in here is you're right, 70% on their national currency. Folks who are holding gold have essentially sidestepped that loss in purchasing power in a very brief period of time. But what's not making the headline news here is that they're also facing economic tragedy and socio-political troubles as well. So you have this worst of world scenario where people may find themselves unemployed just as prices are soaring and doubling almost. So once again, that precious metals safety net catching hopefully as many people as possible.
And Chris, I want to add one other thing too. If you had money in a bank in the Ukraine, can you get it out? Who's to say you can get it out? Down 70%.
Because people are just losing faith in it. So I think the one thing that retains its faith, obviously, for thousands of years, at least thus far, the precious metals. And I also want to say I agree with your thesis that the short-selling concept has just exhausted itself here. Way too many players, hyenas, on the wrong side of this trade. As it reverses direction, it can gain momentum on the upside, just as we saw momentum on the downside as short covering becomes the new theme, because we have a beautiful double bottom pattern in gold, silver, and the XAU. You also have an interesting thoughts on the U.S. gold stockpile. You say the official U.S. coffers at Fort Knox, West Point, and New York Fed facilities could be roughly, as they claim, 8,000 tons, but only 5 tons were repatriated to the Bundesbank. Are officials hiding the true gold stockpile figure? And if so, please tell us why.
Well, I have no doubt about it, right? I mean, all the evidence of the whole German thing. First of all, it wasn't even the Bundesbank that wanted the gold back, but the people that forced the Bundesbank to tell them where the gold was. Then the people forced the Bundesbank to have some kind of repatriation scheme. They said, oh, fine, we'll repatriate. I think the number was 25% of the gold, which is still nothing. And then they do it over 7 years. And I think when they asked to go see the gold at the Fed or Fort Knox, they were refused. And then to find out they got 5 tons, I mean, that is the most paltry amount you can imagine, when we all know that 100 tons a month goes through Hong Kong into China, when the Indians can buy 100 tons a month with no problem, that we can ship, you know, 800 or 900 tons out of the ETFs. And meanwhile, a country that supposedly has 8,200 tons can only deliver 5. It reeks of the gold is gone. It's been leased out and it's not coming back because, as you pointed out earlier, it's over in Asia.
I'm sure you've been watching these numbers on the gold holdings. You've talked about it in the past, in the ETFs, that is. We've seen that gold just pour out of the ETFs, and many folks have commented it may have shipped primarily to the East and much of that in China's coffers.
It's interesting, Chris, when you think that. Let's just use a number of 1,000 tons came out of the ETFs last year. Well, what if the 1,000 tons doesn't come out of the ETF this year? Other things being equal, if you have an annual 4,000-ton supply, you just lost 25% of your supply. So, you know, if we ever got people buying back into the GLD, and then we start comparing a plus number this year with a minus number last year, the effect on the physical gold market would be very staggering.
You also discussed the MF Global and AMRO examples where investors thought they owned precious metals, but when it came time for delivery, well, it just wasn't there. I wonder if you could outline contingencies for investors to help protect themselves from similar scenarios.
Well, Chris, the only thing you can really do is have your gold somehow within your own grasp. It's very difficult to do for a big investor because you don't want it just lying around your house somewhere because it could readily be stolen, but you know, to have, $5,000 or $10,000 or even a larger amount somewhere hidden that only you and a few others know where it is very appropriate. I'm not a believer in the banking system. I just believe this over leverage will someday lead to nothing but bail-in for the depositors. So you got to be careful where you have your gold. There's no perfect answer. We always have to deal with a confiscation thing too. Even if you have it in your own possession, somebody will make a rule that it's illegal to hold it now. Lots of people held on even when that happened in the 30s, but I would recommend that people do that in this institution to be confiscated. But it's very difficult to find the perfect place to store your gold.
I wonder if you have any advice for folks, just the typical, you know, homme moyen, people living in condos, apartments, recreational vehicles, less than savory communities, or who have genuine concerns about the safety of their precious metals. And do you have any positive comments on perhaps storing gold and silver in the very economical Montreal Brinks facility?
Well, we store, you know, in our trusts, we store our gold with the Royal Canadian Mint, who sub that out to Brinks, and I think Brinks, of course, is not a levered financial institution. It's the leverage part of financial institution that scares me. So I feel way better having it in a Brinks or a non-bank custodian, if you will. That's probably the better way of putting it. Somewhere where you feel that financial institution is not going to be vulnerable to some kind of financial chaos. So if you can find that locally, that would be the best thing to do.
Excellent. Well, you've also expressed compelling reasons for owning the mining sector. We haven't really touched on this yet. And yeah, you've given your $4,000 to $5,000 gold target, which is right in line with many folks like James Turk, Jim Sinclair, and many, many other big names in the industry. You say that the gold miners present incredible gold proxies to outperform the sector. Could you please discuss the benefits of owning mining stocks?
Well, I actually start when in that analysis that I've done recently, I just imagine, because I believe it will happen, that the price of gold goes to 2,000. And it's a very simple calculation. Most guys can produce an ounce of gold for $1,000 an ounce. Therefore, at 2,000, you're making $1,000 an ounce. And if you have a 100,000 ounce producer, he's going to make $100 million. And maybe he's got to pay tax, and he nets out $66 million. If there's a 10 multiple, it's worth $660 million. And you turn around and find out his market cap's like 82 or something. And you think, well, we could have a pretty big gain here this year. It's the this year part that's incredibly important. And, you know, the study of the gold trends from the bottom of the on the market back in 2000 suggests that gold should be at 2,100 today and should be something like 2,400 a year. And now the extra $400 would just be even more gravy on top of it. So I think there's, and we've seen, you know, gigantic runs in the gold stocks. The UE index went from 35 to about, I think it was 680, went up close to 1,700% in the last decade. And that's the kind of opportunity that I think is presenting itself, and I think it's presenting itself over a very short-term time period. So that's why I'm keen on the equities.
Just represent such incredible valuations. They have solid discounted cash flows, excellent income statements, and I think that as long as you just try to look for the typical things you're looking for in a solid company, then you have the added benefit of the precious metals insurance policy going forward and the leveraged play from a contrarian perspective. And you also say the biggest problem facing the economy is debt. It's threatening to capsize our titanic economy. How does this impact your gold forecast, the debt situation?
I mean, when I look at the data that the U.S. government provides us as an example, at the end of each year, they provide a number showing what their total debt and contingent liabilities are, the present value of the contingent liabilities. And the last reported year, I think, was something in the $75 to $80 trillion area. So not just the $17 trillion in debt, but the unfunded liabilities, Social Security has nothing in it, Medicare, Medicaid, government pension plans, military payments have got to be made. And this is an organization that has about $2 trillion in revenue and spends about $3 trillion a year. And they got $80 trillion of obligations. Well, I guarantee you one thing. They will not meet those obligations. Now, whether you want to call that default or not, that doesn't bother me. All I know is you don't want to be invested in the financial system where that's the case. And I've done lots of work in the U.S. economy. I could do it on the Japanese or the ECB or Canada or England. Everyone's in the same position where, for the most part, the liabilities are unfunded. We all promised to make these deliveries, but we haven't typically provided for them yet.
I think it's so important. And just think what would happen, because we are living in such a global and international paradigm. Think of how the worldview or the epistemology will shift in such an abrupt manner if suddenly we say, I don't think we're going to make good on our debts here. You could see global outflows from North America and particularly U.S. markets that just boggle the imagination. And I mean, it reminds one of what a wise person once said. Neither a borrower nor a lender be. It should be amended and say, neither a borrower nor a lender should be engaged in careless, reckless borrowing or lending. It just requires personal responsibility, and that's something we haven't held our legislators responsible for. As a nation, we've got to get accountable for our careless fiscal and monetary actions. You also say there is an economic crisis somewhere in the global economy nearly every week. And how can investors shield their portfolios from the looming threat of another financial crisis?
You're playing into my hand here, Chris. Obviously, I'm all in on gold and silver. Okay, I'm not going to participate in stocks because, I just don't. I'm not a believer. If people want to believe in a zero interest rate policy and printing money, fine. You can believe in stocks. I don't believe in a zero interest rate policy. I think it's ridiculous. I don't believe in printing money, which I also think is ridiculous, and they will all have unintended consequences. And as an investor in paper things, you have to be aware of those unintended consequences and adjust accordingly. And, you know, lots of people, I think, realize that those policies aren't working, won't work, but they want to play the game because they're all going to get out in time. Well, as you and I know, not everybody gets out in time, and when you look back at the history of gold just over the last decade, when we went through this whole financial carnage, I mean, it was the one thing that stood in there best of all, and I think that will be the case going forward.
Well, you know, Bill Murphy, a favorite and regular on our show here, a good friend of the show for almost 9 years, is on board with you. He is 100% fully invested, proud to say it, and diversification, he thinks, is diversification. Even if diversification is an outdated relic, given the increase in concerns about capital controls, are you at all considering diversification offshore? And I wonder if you might explain your thoughts on this portfolio safety net.
Well, Chris, the only thing I can tell you is what I do with my own gold, and I have it stored in various places, such as Singapore and Hong Kong and Canada. So, for example, in our funds, we must store it with links in Canada. I think we have our platinum and palladium over in Switzerland. We're always looking for the safest place to store it. And as long as people, you know, feel comfortable putting it in a foreign country, I think one should keep their eyes open to that, particularly with the history of the U.S. government confiscating gold in the 30s. And I wouldn't be surprised to see it happen again.
Very good. I wonder if you could tell our listeners today why bullion is maybe the choice for seasoned investors, while younger investors might be better served by the mining sector.
Well, it depends what you're looking for. If you're just looking for absolute safety, I want my purchasing power to stay the same. I mean, gold has stood that test of time for as long as mankind's been around. But, of course, in equities, you have this massive volatility. Even last year, you know, when gold fell by whatever the number was, 27%, the stocks probably fell by 70% because it leverage cuts both ways here, both good and bad. So it depends on your appetite for risk. I've had lots of appetite for risk in my day, and that's why I've tended to be more inclined to be in equities recently, with gold having come down, the equities just getting trashed. But it depends, you know, whether you're looking for safety or whether you're looking to make an outsized gain. I think the outsized gain is in the equities.
You know, at the past three FOMC meetings, Fed governors have tapered the monthly bond purchasing program by about $10 billion each time. That's brought us down from $85 billion to $55 billion per month. So we're now below that $1 trillion a year in stimulus. The GoldSeek president, Peter Spina, poses this question. What do you view as the true motive behind their tapering actions?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious what the motivation was. The motivation was to keep the banking system together and to provide low interest rate loans to governments. I mean, the huge beneficiary of all the things that have happened since 08 were the financial institutions who essentially, you know, if we would have stopped time right there, I don't think any of them would have had any capital. And then by moving rates down, the bond portfolios go up. The commercial bank can borrow at almost nothing, so they have this, you know, gift of putting out loans and making an automatic return. And in lots of their cases, you know, they're making money every day, trading markets and so on. So I just believe 100% that it was to benefit the banking system throughout the world and also governments.
You know, their plans just might backfire here, because what they've done is allowed the more savvy investor, the smart money from Asia all the way here to North America, an opportunity to just load the boat for. And even if things don't come to pass as we expect them to here, a wonderful beta balancing opportunity for every portfolio that the benchmark for 30, 40 years in financial advising. And I think people are now returning to that.
I hope they do, because it's a smart thing to do.
You know, tensions continue to flare between the West and Russia, and we've touched on this briefly. China has also been under a lot of scrutiny lately, mostly due to their affluence. Peter requests your comments as to how these two wild cards might affect the U.S. dollar and what could be the net impact on gold and silver.
Well, you know, that's very unpredictable, and I don't like to get into, you know, potential military conflicts and stuff like that. And the reason, Chris, I don't is I know there's such a powerful story in the physical market that I don't really need to turn to some black swan to recommend that people get involved. But as you pointed out, black swans are there, right? And at any moment, something can happen which would direct everyone's attention to precious metals. So we know that there's flashpoints there. Whether or not they manifest, I can't honestly tell you. But the whole process of having these sanctions against Russia might ultimately backfire, as it looks like the Russians just want to ditch the dollar. It looks like the China, without saying so, is ditching the dollar as they sold a huge amount of treasury bonds in December. It doesn't look like they're really a net buyer anymore. And many officials there have expressed a deep concern about the U.S. dollar. So my own view is that the dollar will weaken here. The best thing that ever happened to the dollar, of course, was the yen, the pound, and the euro, because they're all fundamentally weak. And that's, of course, one of the reasons it always takes you back to gold, because all of these currencies have inherent weaknesses, but luckily for themselves, they're compared to themselves every day. So there's always one that looks a little better than the other one, but I think the ultimate analysis suggests you have to have the real one, which is gold and silver.
Exactly. You know, speaking of ditching the dollar, I mean, as we look at the agreements that are being made in pacts between nations like China and Iran, Russia and China, you know, we forget that Russia is a major oil producer, that the number one source other than France of electricity in Europe seems to come all the way from Moscow, which has huge number of nuclear reactors. So we have to keep in mind that there are some very interesting, powerful interests who just are losing complete faith in the reserve currency hegemony of the U.S. dollar. The top brass at Goldseek are big fans of your work, and they've requested your upside projection targets for gold and silver. You've suggested we could see as high as 21 to 2400 as soon as this year. Are we still on track?
I can't say we're on trend for sure, because it's been a little halting here so far. But based on all the work that we do and the analysis, supply and demand, I mean, someday it's just going to explode and we'll get back to the norm, which I think is above 2000. And I think at the same time, silver will certainly go through $50. So I'm looking forward to an exciting time here. It's been very frustrating to see how the paper markets have determined the price of the physical gold. But I think the dam is very close to being broken.
People forget that silver tripled in value in just 9 months from 2010 to 2011. You know, silver ran from 17 to 50. If gold followed a similar trajectory, it would be north of 4,000 by Christmas of this year. So, you know, your target, I think, is conservative. I wonder if there are any other topics that you'd like to discuss as we wind down the discussion.
No, I think we've covered it all. I mean, my basic thesis is the governments are effectively bankrupt, that the banks are over-levered. the economy is not doing well. It's not doing well anywhere, for that matter. And we've gone to all these extreme measures to try to keep it together, and what do we get for it? Pretty well nothing. And obviously, gold has proven its merit in other difficult financial times. I think it'll prove it again. And almost everything we look at, whether it's inflation or printing of money or the physical volume for gold, is all gold supportive. And someday the physical buyers will run roughshod over the COMEX.
Please share with our listening audience what the gold and silver product offerings at Sprott Asset Product are today, and as well as the Sprott Asset Management. I understand that you provide all types of interesting services at SprottMoney.com.
Well, we have the listed products on the NYSE and Toronto, which is the Physical Gold Trust, the Physical Silver Trust, a Physical Platinum and Palladium Trust. Within Canada, we have equity, precious metals funds. We have a silver equities fund. We also have funds which just invest in gold and silver for accounts in Canada. We're always trying to create new products that will benefit the mining industry generally. We're working on a number of those products now. We've just signed some joint ventures with Zijin, the largest Chinese gold producer, to seek out investments in Canada. We're also involved with Korea Power in terms of investing some money in the resource area. So we've spent a lot of time between Rick Rule and myself and John Embry and others at our firm in terms of focusing in on the resources in Canada. My own area, of course, has been precious metals in the last 14 years. So there's a lot of products. Anybody who wants to check out our site or see some of our write-ups, they can just go to Sprott.com and navigate the site and see what we have to offer.
Very good. We want to invite you back to GoldSeek.com Radio. Thanks so much.
Okay, Chris. My pleasure. Have a good day.
Exelon Resources, ticker EXN and EXLLF, is a mining company that recently earned top scores on TickerScores.com gold rating service. Exelon owns Mexico's highest grade silver mine. And that's really saying something, because Mexico is known as a top, if not the top, producer of silver worldwide. Plus, it has the benefit of lead and zinc and some other really interesting bits of information that I'll let the CEO get into. So it's a pleasure to welcome the CEO and president, Mr. Cahill.
Glad to be here.
Let's begin with the fact that Exelon has only one mine in production. However, that fact seems to present no problem whatsoever. Your focus is the La Platosa mine, which is the highest grade silver producer in Mexico. As I mentioned, a country that's known for its silver production. It's one of the lowest cost operations nationwide. What would you tell a new prospective investor about your company?
Well, three simple mantras, I guess you could say: high grade, low cost, and cash flow. And yeah, it's only one mine. We only have one operation going right now, but I'd rather have one great high-grade, low-cost, and cash-flowing operation than six or seven operations that are just struggling to survive. The highest-grade producer in Mexico, which is the greatest place to work as a silver producer in the world, 162 million ounces produced back in 2012, very supportive mining culture, a very supportive region for mining. We've got the highest-grade silver mine there. Last year, our production grades were about 718 grams per ton. But as you mentioned, we also have very significant lead and zinc byproduct credits. And we got high-grade zinc. We got high-grade lead as well, 10% zinc, 8% lead. And those really do a lot to lower our cash costs. In this industry right now, silver at $20, that's the key metric. How can you get to cash flow? Where's your operating margin? And with those byproduct credits, really does reduce our operating costs significantly. During 2013, average costs were about $17.29 or so, all in, and our net cash costs per silver equivalent ounce were about $13 or so. So in that 1 to 3 million ounce silver producer space, and that's inside Mexico and outside Mexico, we really are best in class.
No, absolutely. I mean, that's what we read on virtually every site that is reviewing and analyzing the company. This is their favorite producer in its class in Mexico. And, you know, the La Platosa mine contains 20 million silver equivalent ounces in less than 500,000 tons of rock. I was talking with the president here, Peter Spina, this morning. He said he's never come across mineralization like this in his years of visiting mines. He almost likened it to the metal pouring out of the rock. I wonder if you could please outline some of the more impressive technical details for our listeners.
Yeah, I mean, it's a good description. When you go underground, the delineation of ore and waste is so clear that, you know, there's very little dilution at the mine at all, generally less than 10% or so. And you see this extremely high-grade lead, silver ore, and it's just ready to fall out of the ground. You know, the first 5 years of production at Platosa, we produced at over a kilogram per ton. There's no other mine really in the silver producer space that can say that at all. You know, we continue to have months or quarters where we produce at over a kilogram per ton, and we have years of tonnage ahead of us at over a kilogram per ton. And all of our resources that are ahead of us right now are well over a kilogram per ton on a silver equivalent basis. You know, it's a small operation. We produce at about 200 tons per day. But with those kind of grades, you just make incremental improvements to the operation, aim for 210 tons per day. That extra 10 tons, you know, really only a few wheelbarrows full, you're talking about 75,000 ounces a year. 20 tons, another 150,000 ounces a year. So from an operation perspective, that's really been our focus in 2013, is improving the way we get this tonnage out of the ground. And with not significant... you know, we don't need a major transformation of the operation to see significant growth in the number of ounces we can produce, which is the benefit of high grade, and that, you know, keeps our costs low as well.
The core Exelon mission of output maximization and cost minimization, well, it's a recipe for success. I mean, production of 411,000 ounces of silver last quarter. Overall, it looks like the company produced about 1.4 million ounces of silver from just 70 tons last year. That's the most tons milled since you opened the doors there for operation in 2005. Could you please tell listeners about your net cash costs and all-in cost per ounce on silver? This seemed like a very interesting metric.
Our payable net cash cost per ounce was $10.51 per silver ounce last year. But, you know, the more important metric right now is try to get in your G&A, your exploration costs, your CapEx, all the other contributors to where your money goes when it comes out of the ground. And on that basis, last year we were at about $17 per silver equivalent ounce. And we see that, you know, improving this year. And that's grinding down your G&A, being very focused on your exploration, finding efficiencies in your production. And that's exactly what all companies need to do right now. We're actually very, very well positioned to do that.
Exelon reported gross profits of $8.7 million for the year and $200,000 for the quarter, with $2.6 million in reserve at year end. What are your silver and lead, as well as zinc, output plans for 2014, please?
For silver in 2014, we're looking for about 1.4 to 1.6 million ounces. And on a silver equivalent basis, about 2.1, 2.3 million ounces. Lead of about 6 to 8 million, and zinc of about 8 to 10 million pounds each.
You know, the La Platosa mine is facilitated by, well, a very interesting infrastructure, including grid power, local access to the national highway, and close proximity to a relatively large town, which actually includes an international airport. How do you see the infrastructure evolving in the coming years? And please add any additional details regarding the infrastructure as you see fit.
Well, it couldn't get much better than it is, actually. You know, you can be in Houston from 2 hours after leaving the mine site. It's that close to a big city of a million people, Torreon. You land in Torreon, and you drive about half an hour, 40 minutes up the highway, pull in into our driveway, which is about a mile long, the mine site. So very comfortable place to work. You know, our COO lives in a hotel in Torreon and drives into the mine every day. Our workers, there's a town of about 15,000 or so nearby called Bermejillo. They can go home to their families at night. So this isn't a fly-in, fly-out camp. This isn't a camp way up in the mountains that takes 8 hours to get to. Very comfortable place to operate. Makes transportation of ore very simple. Our mill is actually at Miguelauza, in Zacatecas, which is about 200 kilometers away. But since we're right on a major highway, you know, the trucking costs to get the ore from Platosa to Miguelauza are only about $10 to $12 per ton. So very reasonable. And when you're talking about ore this rich that's worth $500, $600 per ton, even at $20 silver, it's just a rounding error. And actually, the Miguelauza story and why it's there is actually an interesting part of Exelon's history. It goes towards the fact of this acquisition we made back in 2009 of Silver Eagle Mines, where we realized basically $50 million of asset value, having the courage to make an acquisition at the bottom of the market. And Silver Eagle was a story where they had 25 million ounces of silver or so. Trying to go to production in 2008, very difficult, as silver plummeted from $20 now to $9. So Exelon, you know, took advantage of that opportunity and for only $4 million in equity or so at the time, acquired a brand new mill, loss carry-forwards, and 400 square kilometers on the epithermal silver belt. A huge win for our shareholders back then, and it's really a good example of what we think the possibilities are in the market right now.
Very good. Well, despite recent market sluggishness, Exelon Resources has set the stage for potential share gains when the silver rebound picks up even more momentum. With your high-grade, low-cost mine in northeastern Durango, which is apparently enhancing your corporate cash flows and profit potential for some solid gains in the years coming forward.
I'm a bit of an explorationist at heart. What we're mining is the periphery of this major carbonate replacement deposit system, which, you know, these systems really generated most of Mexico's silver production for the past 500 years or so. Most of them are owned by majors, by Peñoles, by Grupo México, by Goldcorp. So making that discovery, and we may be really just on the brink of making that discovery, that, I think, gets everybody at the company really excited, and our shareholders have been waiting for it for a long time. You know, the great thing about rock is it doesn't go anywhere. We have a discovery there. We drilled 55 meters of 130 grams per ton silver, 3% lead, 2% zinc, and anomalous gold back in the middle of 2012. You know, we're really excited to follow up on that result. Haven't followed up on it significantly since that drilling, mainly because of market conditions. So we're really excited to get back there. But, you know, this time in the market, and it's that Silver Eagle story that I told, there's some great opportunities out there to acquire assets for, you know, for not too much in the way of cash or shares. And you can make these kind of acquisitions in current periods when things are difficult, and they're going to pay off multifold, you know, in 6 months, 18 months, 3 years. And we're just exceptionally well-positioned, being that high-grade, low-cost, and cash-flowing producer, to be the kind of company that can pull off these acquisitions, just as we did back with Silver Eagle in 2009.
Well, in March, Peter Spina, president of our company here, visited the Durango, Mexico area, spending time at the site with your management. He noticed impressive size on the site, which represents a multi-decade mine of rare potential. How could the property size help enhance shareholder wealth?
Yeah, I mean, there's two things geologists want. They want more drills and more ground. You know, the market's not really providing the drills right now, but we definitely have the ground. Platosa, it sits in the middle of a 400 square kilometer project. So we basically have 10 kilometers in every direction from where the mine site is. And, you know, it is essential if you're going to make these kind of big discoveries to have as much ground to play with as possible. And we're right in the middle of the CRD belt, where all of the biggest carbonate replacement deposits are found. So having a huge ground position right there, that's a key aspect of our exploration outlook going forward. And at Miguelauza in Zacatecas, we've got another 400 square kilometers there on another primary belt in Mexico. So lots of ground, lots of room for, you know, enhancements of the deposit we already have, finding the source of that deposit, but also finding entirely new deposits on both of those projects.
Well, due to the solid Exelon financial situation, engineers have the freedom to search for the next big deposit. Are there any interesting prospects on the radar screen that we haven't discussed so far?
I mean, I think looking forward Q2 and into Q3, we're looking forward to getting the rigs back turning. And part of that is going to be trying to find more of these exceptionally high-grade silver mantos at Platosa. That's going to be the first step of our exploration process. The second part is, you know, looking for more of those, following up on that source discovery that we had back in 2012. Those are the key aspects of our exploration outlook right now.
Moving on to the structure of your company, you've spearheaded an initiative reducing the number of shares outstanding to 55 million, down from 277 million, after financing and building a mine. What was your thinking behind the share rollback?
When we did this, we were looking at the market. We hadn't seen that big fall in gold and silver. We were strategizing about that rollback back in February of 2013, but realizing that this tight capital structure gives us a lot more flexibility in terms of doing acquisitions going forward, in terms of building projects going forward, but also when the market finally turns, and we've all been suffering with this silver and gold market for the past 2 or 3 years now, we're going to have a much better currency, a much more interesting stock to invest in. So from those really two aspects, building a company going forward and allowing our shareholders to get as much return off stock as possible, those are the two key aspects for that rollback in 2013.
Top institutional investors, including Dundee Corp, Sprott Asset Management, and Crystal Fund, represent about 33% of your shareholders. How have your efforts attracted the attention of these noteworthy investors, and what are your plans to pique the interest of new investors?
Well, Sprott's been a longtime supporter of the company since the early 2000s, and the Crystal Fund is out of Europe. We've got a very strong, supportive shareholder base in Switzerland. They basically financed the construction of the mine back in 2004, 2005, and they've stuck with us since. You know, both of them extremely supportive shareholders. In terms of introducing ourselves to new investors, well, that's why I'm talking to you here right now, partially. You know, I think it's a compelling story. High grade, low cost, and cash flow. At $20 silver, we can survive, we can grow. And you can't say that much for that many companies in the space right now. At $25 silver, you know, we're laughing. We're $5 or $10 into the black, making very significant money. At $30 silver, you know, if you go back to 2012 and compare us to our peers, we were generating more cash flow than any of them. And at $30, $35 silver, we've got this incredible exploration play to follow up on. So it's kind of an investment for every season. And it's a difficult season right now, for sure, at $19, $20 silver. But we're one of the few companies that can really take advantage of this difficult period in the market, recognize the opportunities and grow, build a company exactly when you should be.
Very good. Well, in addition to the recent share consolidation, Exelon initiated a share buyback program to buoy the market price, purchasing 232,000 shares at around $1.59. You renewed the option to buy up to 5.2 million shares, or 10% of the float. How will these maneuvers improve shareholder wealth, please?
Yeah, I mean, that's just one more tool in the toolbox, really. In this market, you see big fluctuations in stock prices that sometimes don't really have any bearing in reality. So having that buyback available to us just gives us another opportunity to take advantage of, you know, strange situations in the market that don't reflect the real value of the stock. Nothing more than that, really. We don't plan to do a significant buyback with only 55 million shares outstanding.
So I wanted to move on to your community initiatives, working with local unions. Exelon has organized a number of community initiatives in healthcare, education, culture-related. Now, the company is also running vocational training at the mine, which currently employs about 350 folks, and that's 99% of local workers. I wonder if you could tell our listeners how your efforts have helped to alleviate any union concerns.
Our community efforts are really focused on health and education, and it's a process of, you know, engaging with the communities where our workers live, where the kids grow up. And the idea is we want to provide an opportunity for them, that there's a mine at the end of your driveway, and you can be an engineer, you can be a doctor, we employ a full-time doctor, you can be a geologist, you can be a miner, you can be an electrician. There's just a host of opportunities for you. And, you know, in a place, in many places around the world where mining companies go, these opportunities just aren't available. So it's really focusing on raising the awareness, the importance of education, the importance of staying in school so you can actually get to these jobs that are really, you know, you never have to leave Bermejillo, that they're great paying jobs in your backyard. So that's really the focus of our community engagement. It's very important that people know that there's this opportunity there. And it's great for us as well because, you know, we want to be in an area where there is a good workforce, a well-educated workforce that grows up in a culture where they understand the importance of safety in mining. They understand the value that mining brings to communities. So that it's a really that's the kind of holistic approach we take to our community engagement, and you know that ranges from working with schools, helping build school infrastructure, donating computers, designing computer programs and computer teaching programs, to bringing in speakers. We had Jared Borghetti, who is the leading scorer from Mexico internationally, played in the Premier League for a while. He was speaking to the local community a few weeks ago, talking about the importance of staying in school, the importance of working hard, the importance of values, which is the key thing. A lot of these areas, people need good role models that are sorely lacking. And that's one of the great things about mining, is that mining companies go to places where nobody else does. They really pave the way for the hospitals, for the schools, the simple roads and electricity that bring goods to areas that may not be as well served as they should be.
Very good. Well, you know, investors are anxious to hear your thoughts regarding the potential for an oversized prospect at the La Potosa deposit. Our president here, Peter Spina, compares the property with world-class carbonate deposits in Mexico throughout several of these deposits here. I won't go through the list, but including Goldcorp's 45-million-ton Penasquito property. How does your property compare to some of these? And please outline some similarities.
Our property right now is a much smaller prospect. Penasquito is obviously huge, but we're only on the very periphery of this major system. Highest grade silver mantos in the world, really. We've got decades of exploration, decades of mining out ahead of us to try to find that Penasquito, which is there lurking somewhere. But it is the potential of the property. When you get into these carbonate replacement deposits, you're looking at 10 to 15 to 100 million tons. Of ore, and people look for these deposits because they're polymetallic, extremely rich. You've got gold, copper, as well as silver, lead, and zinc. And a good example, you know, Penasquito is one, but only about 20 kilometers from Potosa is a mine known as Ouela, and that was the birthplace of Peñoles. Grupo Peñoles is now a $30, $40, $50 billion company back in the late 1800s, and that was mined till 1932, and you had 4 or 5 grams per ton gold, as well as high-grade silver, lead, and zinc, and there's still huge reserves left there, though too deep to mine right now. That mine created a community around it. It's a UNESCO heritage site right now. Great place to visit. There's a suspension bridge that's really a marvel of engineering, and a whole town around it. The whole town just grew around this mine, and they mined it for 50 or 60 years or so. But these kind of deposits, ultimately, they were mined by the Spaniards, and they've been mined by major corporations for not just decades, but centuries. So that's the kind of potential that really is there at Potosa. And we're only on the edge of where we're going right now.
Excellent. Well, you know, Exelon put a promising $18 million exploration program on hold due to the volatile silver market conditions. Nevertheless, the drill results are indicative of a mine with solid potential. For instance, in early 2012, one of your discoveries there revealed solid silver, lead, and zinc, as well as gold. How do you plan to proceed with this discovery on a forward basis?
The long-term exploration goal of Potosa has always been to find the source of these very high-grade mantos that we've been mining. And it wasn't until mid-2012 that we actually had what we would call a discovery hole. And we hit that 55 meters of 130 grams per ton silver, 3% lead, 2% zinc, and anomalous gold. And gold's a key factor. We'd never really seen gold at Potosa before in any degree at all. Very, very anomalous sniffs. But seeing that gold, that means you're getting closer to the heart of the system. And we started to see copper as well. Next hole we drilled was 143 meters of 146 grams per ton silver, good lead, good zinc, good gold as well. And then we followed that up with 7 meters of 13 grams per ton gold. So, you know, a significant gold component as well, which means that the ultimate source of these mantos, the ultimate goal of our exploration, could have a big gold component, will have a big silver, lead, and zinc component, may have a copper component as well. That's the great thing about these deposits, is that it's not just a gold deposit, it's not just a silver deposit. You don't really know what kind of deposit it's going to be until you get into the thick of it. But it's a deposit that makes money. It's a deposit that's extremely profitable, really in any kind of silver, gold, copper, lead, or zinc price environment. One of the best kind of deposits you can find.
Well, clearly Exelon is poised and fully committed to garner profits from the La Potosa mine while fortifying the company treasury And this in turn could improve the exploration operations while increasing the likelihood of discovering that next big headline making large tonnage property.
Well, I think that's exactly it. That, you know, 2013 was a very difficult year for the industry. We were particularly affected by silver prices dropping from $32 down to $19 in December. You had to be careful with your exploration money during that period. You had to make sure that you were going to survive for the next year. But right now, we're well positioned. I think Exelon is going to surprise a lot of people with its cash flow and profitability through 2014. Just far better position than we were to withstand this kind of silver price, and far better position, I think, than many of our peers in the industry right now.
Very good. Well, Mr. Cahill, I wonder how investors could follow your company's progress.
Well, you can check out our website at www.exelonresources.com. Check us out on the TSX. Our symbol is EXN. And we're on the OTC bulletin board at EXLLF.
And we want to welcome you back to GoldSeek.com Radio in the future, sir.
Thanks very much, Chris.
GoldSeek employees may or may not own shares of Exelon Resources. Nothing contained herein should be construed as investment advice.
Hey Chris, this is Robert Ian with HunkerChange.com. Everywhere you look, significant tensions are rising across the country and around the globe. As economies contract, the law of scarcity is asserting itself as people and groups fight for what are noticeably fewer and fewer deck chairs on a sinking economic ship. The Clive and Bundy story is being packaged and shaped by mainstream media to serve multiple political agendas. As time passes, it appears to have less to do with alleged illegal cattle grazing and is becoming a lightning rod for a host of hot-button issues from states' rights to federal authority to militias to taxation to numerous others. Realistically, it cannot serve all these issues, because a confused mind does nothing. And isn't that the point? When an issue initially has legs and has a significant chance of success, that is when it is the biggest threat to those who oppose it. The best way to kill an issue that is gaining traction and that people can easily understand, at least initially, is to water it down with so many other issues they may not be able to agree with that they intellectually let go of their association to that idea and decide to wait for something easier and clearer to understand. Such is the soup of the modern media and how easy it is to misdirect and close people's minds to what is, or at least was, initially a simple idea. But that's the point. The ability for any real discourse to take place for any extended period of time on any single subject before being polluted with all kinds of extraneous information and agendas that are designed to peel away interest and credibility from the initial subject matter is so limiting our attention spans before we get diverted to inaction that the status quo remains pretty much the same. And the march toward less freedom and more surveillance continues. If you watch how this relatively simple story has morphed into issues that were never on the table in the first place, you can see how desperate those in power are to shapeshift the information that is conveyed to the masses and refocus various political agendas into a divide and conquer mindset. Change will happen quietly, slowly, surely, and it will happen one person at a time. That's why the most important catalyst for change is not the president. It's not the media. The most important catalyst for change is you. And until next time, this is Robert Ian with ConquerChange.com, reminding you to follow us on Twitter @ConquerChange. Thanks, Chris.